May it please the court. Good afternoon, Your Honor. Steve Browerman of Byard in Wilmington, Delaware. Joining me at council table are Jeffrey Greaves and Darren Carrero of Pillsbury Winthrop Shaw Pittman in Washington, D.C. Mr. Greaves has been admitted pro hoc vice in this matter, and with the court's permission, will present the argument on behalf of appellant BLGH Holdings, LLC.
Thank you. Welcome to the court.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. I understand you'd like to reserve 4 minutes. And when I start the clock, you'll see it reading 20 minutes and the light will be green and it will count down. And when it turns yellow, you'll be into the time you've reserved. You can continue, but you will be using the time you reserved.
Good afternoon, Justice Holland. Thank you. Jeffrey Greaves on behalf of appellant BLGH Holdings, Inc. The question in this case revolves around the meaning of a unit purchase agreement by which BLGH sold its asset, an operating company called Beacon, which owned two landfills that produced what is called offtake gas and sometimes is called biomethane or renewable biomethane gas, to pipeline operators for which it received renewable energy credits. The parties to this contract, the unit purchase agreement, were sophisticated parties in the sense that they were represented by outside counsel and anticipated negotiations. BLGH eventually sold its interest in the operating companies to Appalese and Exco for a few things, some consideration in the form of debt management, the potential for future payouts under the contract, and the potential to receive an additional, what was called a bonus payment in Section 1.7. There were certain prerequisites to Anexco agreeing to do this deal, and here the sequencing, I think, becomes very important for the court's consideration. This will be a de novo review of the trial court's decision, of course, awarding summary judgment against my client in connection with the interpretation of the agreement. The critical language in the agreement is that there is a consummation of the sale and that the transaction outlined in Section 6.1 of the unit purchase agreement was accomplished or consummated with documentation in form and substance reasonably satisfactory to the buyer. That is the entirety of the bonus provision. If you look at Section 6.1 of the agreement, what it revolved around was a letter of intent, a form of which was attached to the transaction documents. That letter of intent was step one. Anexco was not going to purchase Beacon until there was a letter of intent in place to have the potential for a substitute gas offtake agreement.
Well, turning to 6.1, which is referenced in Section 1.7. Is it correct that the only part of 6.1 that bears on this dispute is subsection F?
That's correct, Justice Jacobs.
No one is contending that there's any other term or clause in Section 6.1 that's relevant here?
Yes, Justice Jacobs, that's exactly correct. 6.1F is descriptive in that it tells you that the only thing that is required is that the letter of intent not be terminated or canceled.
All right. 6.1F states the letter of intent attached hereto as Exhibit E shall remain in full force and effect and shall not have been terminated. Exhibit E is the shell LOI.
Correct.
I gather no one disputes that the letter, that at all relevant times, the letter of intent was in full force and effect and wasn't terminated.
That is correct. And one of the important things about that is that substantial consideration was paid to keep it.
Before you get to one of the important things about it, my question is, why would not, since subsection F doesn't refer or allude to the contents or the substance of the shell letter of intent, Why doesn't the argument end at that point, or the analysis conclude at that point?
Yeah, we argued that point to the trial court, and I think you'll see that.
Are you arguing it to us? Because, I mean, I think you did allude to it in your brief, but most of the briefs get into, drill down into the substance of the letter of intent.
And Your Honor, Justice Jacobs, the reason we did that is because the trial court determination revolved around a comparison, if you will, which we don't think he needed to do. We think the dispositive language is found in Section 1.7.
Okay, so one of your arguments then would be that the trial court erred because it need not have looked past the language of subsection F of Section 6.1, that's the only condition that needed to be fulfilled in order for the bonus right to trigger.
Well, with a caveat. Now, the trial court had to rely on some modicum of extrinsic evidence to determine that a final deal had been reached.
All right.
So, with that caveat, any final deal that was reached between Inexco and Shell, first of all, was no concern of my client. They weren't involved in the negotiations. But secondarily,
that's an extrinsic fact that nobody contested either. Correct? That a final deal.
Well, correct. And
all right, but I gather, you know, once we get past that argument, the next level of argument is really deals with the issue of whether the right to a bonus depended on there being a transaction with Shell that was concluded, or whether the transaction with Shell had to conform to certain requirements. And your position is that there was nothing in the relevant contractual provisions that made the right to a bonus hinge or be triggered by any substantive requirements or provisions in the Shell LOI, only that there be a final completed deal with Shell.
Subject to the timing by December 15th. That's correct, Justice Jacobs.
Okay.
There's no judicial review or determination or nature of anything other than mandatory. The bonus provision says shall.
At least at this, on the second level of argument, your position is that there was no need and certainly no basis for the court to inquire as to whether the final terms of the Shell transaction or contract were identical to, or were different from, or substantively the same as, take whatever adverbs you want to, that there was no basis to do that kind of an inquiry.
That's correct. The plain and unambiguous terms of the contract should have been given effect to by the court as stated in the contract.
Okay, then there's a last level, a third level, which presupposes, or at least arguendo, that the legal inquiry getting to whether or not your client was entitled to a bonus does require some juxtaposition of the terms of the final contract with Shell and the letter of intent. And even if, and basically is to the effect that even if there is some comparison or contrast that is called for, that there was no material variance but between the deal terms as they ultimately were agreed to and the deal terms as they were outlined in the LOI. Is that correct?
I think that's a good point. I would be a little bit broader than that in the sense that such a determination is a fact issue, just as the question of reasonableness. If the facts are undisputed in front of a jury still gets to decide what's reasonable and what is not. And substantial compliance presents the same type of fact-bound issue that, at a minimum, would require a court to have some.
There should not have been a summary judgment
further proceedings
on that issue. It should have been a factual determination on a trial record.
Yes, yes. And if
what are the essential parts of the transaction that had to remain or had to be carried out?
Yeah,
parties. Obviously, you have to have the same parties. Nothing else?
No, I think there are a few things. I think if you read the letter of intent, it defines the term proposed transaction, and it tells you that it has to be a transaction involving renewable biomethane, and then it has to evolve from these projects, and it has to be involving Shell, and it has to be involving Beacon. Now, beyond that, I think the parties were given a lot of flexibility to structure the deal as they wanted it. One of the things that is different about this letter of intent is it does specifically say that the parties may agree to such terms, events, and conditions as they may modify, delete, or add them in each party's sole discretion. So the letter of intent was done first.
Where does the value of the deal fit into that? You know, they tried to quantify the difference in the value of this compared to the letter of intent. Let's assume it's relevant at all. If it was a 50% value, would you still get the payment, or is the value completely irrelevant, or is it a consideration?
The value is the opportunity of the hedge. In other words, to not have a deal going forward with the terms that Beacon had with Connective, the offtake supplier who had been in place, and to have the opportunity instead to create a better deal if they could find one with Shell. That's why the LOI was done first. Anexco didn't want to talk to our client until that was in place. The day after that, the UPA was negotiated and finished and concluded. So there was ample time between the conclusion of the LOI and the conclusion of the UPA that gives my client the bonus. If they were insistent upon the terms of the LOI, they knew what they were at that point. They could have put in language that would have said something like, consummate a transaction substantially as represented in Exhibit A to the LOI, or consummate a transaction that is
It's not materially
found.
Dissimilar from...
Exactly. So I think the sequencing here helps you, because the LOI was first. The second component of this deal, if it was going to happen, was a purchase and sale agreement between the parties, the one that has the bonus provision. And the kicker was the ability to terminate the Connective arrangement. The Connective arrangement with the prior offtake gas provider, was inked the next day after that, and then the parties closed on the UPA. So without those pieces in place, the ability to hedge, if you will, to enter into a more favorable set of terms and conditions, if they wanted to, was what they were paying for with the bonus. It's a lever, either it's up or down, and that's how it was intended to work. And I really do think the best evidence of that is the statements that were made by Anexco during this process, where every model they had the calculus built into it that they were going to pay the bonus.
When you say this process, do you mean the negotiations leading up to the agreement?
Yes.
Anexco, the purchase agreement?
The process of them modeling the benefits they may get under the transaction and them selling this, if you will, to their own board included representations that BLGH, my client, would be given a success fee if a substitute gas offtake agreement happened on any terms. That's as loose as it was.
Right, that's your second, the second position, or the second line of argument I was referring to before. Is
right,
that correct?
Right.
Let me ask you a question about the record itself. The other side's contention in support of the result and the analysis of the trial court is that your client's right to a bonus is dependent upon there being no, and these are my words, not theirs, no material dissimilarity between the Shell deal as it actually occurred or actually evolved and the letter of intent, that is, the terms outlined in the letter of intent.
That was their position in front of the trial court, correct?
My question is there any evidence of record that during the negotiation process, this view of the purchase agreement was communicated by them to your client?
A harder question, because there were certainly representatives of Beacon who were bought in the transaction and carried forward. So the same people were there. So in other words, individual A on the project.
I'm just asking if there's anything in the record before us.
I don't think there's anything that would tell you directly that they committed to paying the bonus. But I do think the court can take a peek at that as evidence of what they intended to do and how they thought the contract operated. So I'm not trying to play a game of gotcha where we pin on them the fact that they told us they were going to pay it. I don't think we can do that. I think you still have the power to interpret the contract and determine whether or not it's payable.
I'm not sure what your answer is. If your answer is yes, this is a position they took during negotiations and they communicated it to your client.
They never communicated to our client during the process that the bonus is going to be paid. They communicated it to themselves.
The bonus is going to be dependent on there being no material dissimilarity. Choose your words.
No communications on that one way or the other.
Why shouldn't there be a trial on what was intended by the parties?
Well, I don't think you get to that issue because I think what you have here is the problem that this court identified in the Myers case, which is you have a trial judge who tried to ascertain subjectively what the parties thought the contract meant. The proper test is the objective test, which is to say what would a reasonable person in the position of the parties think they were getting. The language that the trial judge latched onto, the substantial comparison language, is found in cases where the contract said, if it's substantially compliant with these terms, you will get paid.
Well, here it's the phrase transaction outline. Is it arguable that that can be interpreted differently in a reasonable way?
I don't think so. I think there's more room for that than there would be in reading in substantial compliance. But when you outline something, it is intended to be a very preliminary account of it, or giving a hint. I think the LOI is just a bookmark, really, for the beginning of the negotiations. So when you're talking about the transaction, you're not talking about the terms or the conditions of the transaction. You're talking about the concept in as much as the sale of renewable biomethane gas from Party A to Party B for these particular projects. I don't think a trial is needed on that issue because I think it's clear and unambiguous that what is meant is that the LOI remained in force and effect, and that a deal, any deal, for the sale of biomethane gas with Shell was done on terms. And when you get into that, it's that were reasonably satisfactory. The form of the documentation was reasonably satisfactory to Anexco. That's a point that they admitted away in this case. They admitted they were reasonably satisfied with the documentation and the form. And so I think what you have is the court getting into that and trying to impose a discretionary component here when there wasn't one,
I thought you were also making the argument, and tell me if I have it wrong, that even if we focus on the word as outlined in Exhibit 6.1, the outline includes language that expressly envisions both Shell and BLGH
Anexco.
Modifying in their discretion the terms that are outlined. That is, that are set forth in text in the letter of intent.
Right. Like every other unenforceable agreement, it has aspirational terms that could be modified by the parties. I would like to save some time for rebuttal, so unless the court has any further questions for me, I'll step aside.
Good afternoon, Your Honors.
Good afternoon.
May it please the court, Joel Mullen on behalf of Anexco. And I'd like to start off by addressing two of the questions that Justice Jacobs just asked Mr. Greaves. And the first one is, you asked whether or not there was any evidence of an express statement that the bonus depended upon execution of the transaction that we claim is outlined in the letter of intent. And I'd ask Your Honors to look at the email exchange that is at page B-167 in particular. And if you look at that email exchange, it's an email exchange dated May the 21st, 2010. And in it, the general counsel of Inexco is advising BLGH that they're willing to re-engage in negotiation. And he attaches to the letter the key terms of the transaction. And paragraph 2 of the key terms is that there will be an agreement with Shell that is for 15 years at a price of $9 with a 2% escalator, and one that provided us flexibility in the production of the gas. And
what is the site to that?
It's B00167. It is the email
that's
the
trial court relied on when it compared what actually happened to say that these are two different deals.
And they were two different deals. And so I'd like to then talk to, about the second issue that I thought Justice Jacobs raised, and that is, what is the reference in 1.7? And it is true that it says that the transaction outlined in section 6.1F has been consummated. So if you look at 6.1F, what it tells you is the letter of intent is in force and effect. It has got to be a reference to the substance of the letter of intent. The transaction outlined has been consummated. The only way that you figure out what the transaction is that was to be consummated is by actually looking at the letter of intent. And then we look at the letter of intent, and we attempt to ascertain what does the letter of intent mean.
Were you talking about section 6.1F?
I was, Your Honor.
All that language says is the letter of intent, and then ellipsis, shall remain in full force and effect and shall not have been terminated. Where in that language is there any reference to the substance of the letter of intent?
Well, it says the letter of intent attached here to is Exhibit E, which is the substantive agreement. And then the question is what do they mean in 1.7 when they say, and the transaction outlined in Section 6.1F. There's no transaction. I mean, if we want to be absolutely literal, there's no transaction outlined in 6.1F. It's referring to the letter of intent.
Fair point.
And I don't think that any...
Except that, if that's where you're going, isn't it also required that anyone reading that language and interpreting it take into account that the terms that are outlined are subject to negotiation by the parties and subject to modification in their discretion or in the party's discretion?
Well,
I'm paraphrasing.
Okay, and I've got two responses to that. I mean,
well, the first response ought to be a yes or no.
Okay, the answer is no, Your Honor.
You ignore that language?
Well, I don't ignore it, but I think that you have to read it in context and in the paragraph in which it is written. So I would say, first of all, it is a truism that letters of intent are not binding and that the terms of letters of intent can be altered. And this letter of intent says, I would suggest, in three different spots that it is not a binding letter of intent and its terms can be altered. But if you look at the specific language that they point to, which is in paragraph 1.1A, which, and I'm looking at the excerpts of record B, so it would be B0070, it says that, and these are the non-binding provisions, that the parties are going to negotiate the good faith negotiation, execution, and delivery. And then if you go on, look at the parenthetical. It says, as such terms may be modified, deleted, or added to in each party's sole discretion. Well, it's not one party's sole discretion whether or not to execute an agreement. And what it refers to is the good faith negotiations. The only binding obligation on Shell in this agreement is that it negotiate in good faith. We've got a no-shop provision. Their only obligation is to negotiate in good faith. So when it says the party's sole discretion, it's simply saying that they don't breach their duty of good faith if they changed the terms. But if a reasonable person is looking at this agreement and saying, what is the transaction outlined in the letter of intent? The only, you know, when we think about transactions, we think about price, term, and quantity. In sale of a commodity, those are the three things. And the parties agreed on the price, they agreed on the length of the agreement, and they agreed on the quantity. And that's what is set out in Exhibit A. That is the transaction outlined. And again, referring back to the email, the May 21st email, it says that it is a key term of the agreement, and there must be a letter of intent in place that has that as a minimum term. That's what it says. And looking at this, as I think the court has to do.
So if the term was 14 years, there'd be no bonus?
Well, so that's, and that's where you get into an issue. And so I would say what I told the Judge Silverman was that the answer to that question is yes, that if the term is 14 years, there would be no bonus. And the reason that I articulated it that way, and we cited to the court some cases on bonus payments, and that bonus payments are unique in the sense that it's over and above the regular remuneration. Mr. Greaves said that there was going to be some debt relief. Well, what my client did was pay off $12 million of debt. That was some debt relief. And then they said, and you have up to $65 million that you can recover based upon the performance of the facility. And as a bonus payment, if you execute the transaction outlined in the letter of intent, you can get the difference between $6 million and how much it costs to cut off connective. So I would say that, yes, it has to be strictly construed. Now, Judge Silverman looked at it differently, and he said, no, it doesn't have to be strictly construed. And he pointed, and there's some, I think both sides argued some cases out of Virginia, and there's the Hummer case, which is cited in the Akers case in the Supreme Court decision. And what it held was that if there is, and this was in the case of a real estate agent bringing a transaction to a buyer, the buyer obligated to purchase and not buy. And the question was the deal that was presented the transaction that the real estate agent was going to get a bonus payment for? And the court held, as a matter of law, it was not. And a matter of law, it was not because it was materially different. And that was Judge Silverman's analysis.
Is it correct that before Judge Silverman, your side argued that in order for BLGH to be entitled to the bonus, that the deal, the final deal with Shell, or the terms of the final deal, had to be precisely the same as the terms as outlined in the letter of intent?
As I just said, that was my position. That okay. Is correct.
And Judge Silverman rejected that.
He did reject that.
He said you need to give some effect to this language that's contained in section 1.1A of the letter of intent that refers to as such terms may be modified, deleted, or added to in each party's sole discretion.
I don't think that he, in his bench ruling, said that that was the basis for his determination that it did not have to be precisely the same. I don't think that's how he articulated.
Okay.
Decision.
Let me ask you this then: what role, if any, did Judge Silverman conclude this language played in the analysis, that is, the modification, deletion?
I don't think that he believed that, and the transcript, Your Honors have the transcript. I think that he understood it the way that I've expressed it, that it is a truism, that it was a limitation on the parties. It made it clear that a party did not breach their duty of good faith negotiation if they were to insert language in the final agreement that was different from what was in the transaction.
Okay. Well, from some source or other, he latched on the concept of substantial similarity or
and,
not.
And this is from those Virginia, I think it's very similar to those Virginia Supreme Court cases that I mentioned.
Okay, and read that into the contract, I gather, as an implied requirement.
Yeah, I think.
Or did he root
well,
it?
Excuse me.
Let me ask my question.
Okay.
Did he root it anywhere in the text of the agreement or any of the exhibits, any of the documents that both sides agree, you know, form the body of instruments that we have to analyze to get to solve this problem?
I think he did, Your Honor, and I think he did in assessing what is the transaction that is outlined and that.
But can you link that to the substantial similarity or whatever, the you know, without being too precise about the wording?
Yeah, and I think that the way you link it is, and the way he linked it was, that if there was some trivial difference, our reasonable expectation, contractual expectation would be that we would have to pay the bonus. But that if there was a material difference, that an objective third party looking at this would say that our reasonable expectations would be that we would not have to pay the bonus. And that when you look at this transaction and you see that the price is different, the term is different.
Okay, wait.
Okay.
Excuse me. I gather from what you just said that, number one, that this line of analysis is not rooted in the agreement at all, that it starts with the concept or at least the model of what a reasonable person entering into this contract would expect, and then somehow from there gets to the conclusion that your clients are arguing for, which is that there be an identity of terms, or at least not a material dissimilarity.
That's
the last element that I'm curious about, because where does that come from, even if you start with where Judge Silverman started from?
Well, the source of our argument were these Virginia Supreme Court cases that we cited, which was in the context of a real estate contract where the agent came in and said, I'm entitled to my bonus, and the Virginia Supreme Court, citing to a case called Hummer, came to the conclusion that no bonus was required, no commission was required, because the terms of the deal on its face that the broker brought to the buyer was materially different from the deal that the buyer had agreed to pay the commission on. And I think that's not a great leap. It is what reasonable people would expect.
Well, it may not be a great leap if A, Virginia law applies, and B, the contract that was involved in the Virginia case is substantially the same or identical to the contract that's at issue here. Is that the case?
Well, certainly Virginia law does not apply. And this contract is not the same, but I think the legal concept is one rooted in the same notion that is applied repeatedly by this court, which is that you look at a contract as how a reasonable, objective third party would look at the contract, and whether a reasonable, objective third party, in looking at the language transaction outlined, would think that, what would that reasonable party think? They would think, well, what's the price? What's the term? And what are the duties with respect to delivery? And if all three of those are different, which they are here, and they are substantively different, then it is not the transaction outlined. And what Judge Silverman asked himself from the bench was, could a reasonable jury come to the conclusion on the basis of a comparison of the transaction that was executed with Shell and the letter of intent, that this was the transaction outlined, and he held as a matter of law that a reasonable jury could not come to that conclusion.
Is it fair to say that the analysis that Judge Silverman engaged in and your side's position is rooted entirely in the language that's to the effect of as outlined in, and I forget what the...
Yeah, the transaction outline.
Outline, okay. Not in the text of Section 6.1F.
Well, again, I mean, I think the answer is, I guess I would say it is also rooted in 6.1F, and we address this because I believe that when 6.1F says the letter of intent attached hereto shall remain in full force and effect, to understand what the transaction outlined is, you have to look at the letter of intent itself.
Maybe let me rephrase the question. That the language of 6.1F is not indispensable to the line of reasoning that gets you to the result.
That I agree with. That is correct, Your Honor. That is correct, Your Honor. If I may, and I've already mentioned the fact that my client identified the terms of the letter of intent as key terms at B-167, and I just wanted to address briefly two other aspects of the extrinsic evidence that has been cited to you by BLGH. The first one is, and they start out their reply brief with a quotation that to the and a citation to the record at A18 to the effect that if the transaction closes, then the bonus will be due. But what they don't tell, Your Honors, is that the email is dated June the 6th, 2010, before the letter of intent was executed, before the agreement was executed, and therefore can't be any evidence of what my client believed, or any evidence that my client somehow believed that the transaction outlined was other than the 15 years, the $9, and the flexibility. So that quotation in their brief is to an email dated June the 6th, 2010.
Mr. Mullen, that gets me to the same question that I asked your friend on the other side, and that is, is there any evidence on this record that during the course of the negotiations of the what ended up as the purchase agreement, that your side communicated to BLGH its view that for BLGH to be entitled to the bonus, that there would have to be no material dissimilarity between the ultimate Shell deal and the one that was outlined in the letter of intent?
Not with respect to the bonus per se, but my client did convey that a key term of the agreement was that a letter of intent with the 15 years at $9 with the flexibility be enforced at the time of the execution of the agreement. So if my client expressed that view, that the letter of intent had to be in place, it is a necessary consequence that the transaction outlined in that letter of intent is what you're referring to when they are to get the bonus.
Is that the B-0167 reference that you gave me?
It is, Your Honor.
All right. And does the record show whether or not there was any response to that particular communication by the other side?
There is not in the record a response to that communication.
Okay, so there's no evidence outside the four corners of the various instruments that there was a meeting of the minds on that point. It's distinguished from a communication from one party to the other.
I would say, I guess I would disagree, Your Honor, and I've got to stop. I'm over my time.
Go ahead and finish the answer.
Thank you. I would disagree, Your Honor, because at the time and on the face of that email, At the time that the parties were at, they had broken off negotiations, and they resumed negotiations following my client's sending of that email. So I would suggest that there was a meeting of the minds, that that was a key term.
Well, I want to ask one follow-up question. And based on that, why shouldn't there be a trial as opposed to summary judgment?
Well, I don't think that, you know, I guess I would take the position that the language is clear on its face that the transaction outlined is Exhibit A. But if your honors are of the view that there's some ambiguity as to what it is transaction outline means, I think the reference is clear from that one email. And if we need to have a trial on whether or not there was a meeting of minds as to what that meant, and what the consequence is if there wasn't a meeting of the minds, because that's the next question. There apparently was not, I mean, this disagreement arose before execution of the final shell agreement.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
At argument before the trial court, he became hung up on the notion that the bonus was automatic, and it bothered him in some sense that my client didn't have to do anything to earn the bonus. However, by engaging in that line of reasoning, it led him to add a limitation in the contract to look at the bonus more strictly. That's not a feature of Delaware law. The Virginia Supreme Court, and I'm a Virginia lawyer, the Akers case had language in it that awarded the commission to the real estate agent if there was substantial compliance.
But didn't the other side say that it cited other cases that did not have that language?
It cited the Hummer case, and the Hummer case was an agricultural real estate case, and it didn't have those words in it. What it said, the Hummer case started as that analysis that a court engages in where it says the inverse of a material breach is substantial compliance. In that case, I think the realtor was suing for his commission, and as a consideration of him doing that, he had to be able to demonstrate substantial compliance, and namely that he wasn't in breach or the other side was in breach. So it didn't start out that way. A later Virginia Court of Appeals decision, which is unusual because Virginia's intermediate appellate court doesn't usually weigh in on these things, said that they distinguished Akers on the ground that in another contract that came before them, it didn't have the substantial compliance language, and they didn't read it into the contract. So the Virginia Supreme Court had its original ruling in Akers with that contract language, and then an appellate court in Virginia had a later issue where it didn't have it and it didn't read it in. That's where the court, I think, tried to impose a limitation that is just not present in the contract. The case that Your Honors might recall on that we cited to is Myers, and it deals precisely with that issue.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you for the arguments. The court will take the matter under advisement, and we will adjourn.